Welcome to all the members present. Welcome presenters from the two organizations. It's the first time that we deal with the budget in this way, where we have public hearings on the fiscal framework and then also the revenue proposal. Listen what the people out there, organizations, telling us, and in terms of the Moneyball Amendment procedure that made it Act 2009, giving us specific procedures how to go about and to deal with the budget, which is an ongoing project. So welcome to the members. Important one. God, we need to reflect on that a lot more carefully, but so also is the element of macroeconomic policy that does have a bearing on both the fiscal policy as well as the issues of expenditure and where the government is directing itself. The other macro issues that we think should be considered by this committee and which is a central part of the budget is questions that relate to the interest rates and the whole question of inflation targeting. No discussion about monetary and fiscal policy can be complete without taking those issues into account. We'd also today like to talk more specifically about what it is that we need to do in respect of the tax proposals. We've looked at those elements that are contained within the budget presently, the fuel taxes, the environment taxes, and the question of tax relief that was granted in this budget, an area that we find great difficulty dealing with, even though the explanations about the creeping effect on many of the upper income earners is given as a rationalization. We think we have to look at that a lot more carefully. Our proposals will then target on what it is that we are able to do in respect of zero rating additional items that can bring immediate relief, and what it is that we need to consider doing in respect of using the budget as a key redistributive tool within the economy and within the society and within government and public policy. And so that's to look at the question of wealth taxes, because if the inequalities in our country are getting worse, the levels of extravagance in sections of our community is even more exorbitant today than what it was before 1994, then we've got to do something about both bringing about an important area of revenue collection by taxing the wealthy more, but also being able to make sure that we do respond to the inequalities that exist, and the budget is indeed one of the key redistributive measures. My colleagues are going to go into detail of our submissions, and I'd like to call on them at this point to introduce themselves and the key perspectives that they bring, and then our main presenter for the submission of the People's Budget Coalition will be Prakashini Govender from the People's Budget Coalition. But I call firstly Woody Harum, who will make some opening comments. Come on, Woody.
Well, thanks for telling me. The National Union of Metal Workers, it's made its position very clear when we presented at the medium-term budget policy statement hearing. And the issues are not new. So we just, we don't want to go into detail repeating the issues, because I think CASASA was adequately, the PBC and CASASA has adequately covered that. But the worry is that now, and we're going to be seeing this, and we're going to be feeling this much more, at its National Executive Committee meeting about a week ago, NUMSA pronounced itself very clearly on the energy thing, and they've been sending out strong signals that, look, we're not going to be accepting these kind of price hikes, and given the fact that it's going to hurt a lot of people. And I think if as the cities claim that this was a very good budget, we're going to see a lot of the good work then probably undone by this increase that we just had. So I think in summary, the unions are very, very concerned that the impact it's going to have on employment, the cost implications of this, and that the brunt is really going to be felt by the working class and the poor. We've made statements about inflation targeting and the role of the Reserve Bank, and I'm not going to go into that because I think that debate must go back to the bank, and the union's been quite clear on this. So they're not going to leave this in their position. They're going to continue taking up their position, and they're going to continue making their arguments about the role of the Reserve Bank. I think the other issue is, and this is of something that concerns us, is that in 2008 there was an agreement at NEDLAC. And this was in response to a Section 77 notice from CASATU on food price increases. Now, the task team that was responsible has drawn up certain areas of agreement. And the one area of agreement that they had was that when it came to the issue of social grants, the least government could do was to actually implement an increase that was in line with the inflation rate. And we're not seeing that happening. We're not seeing that happening now. I think the increase of 10 Rand for the child support grant is absolutely pathetic. I mean, a 10 Rand increase translates to 4.2%, which is way under inflation. we're not sure on the, you know, as to how government is going to respond to this, but we'd like to take them and challenge them on this and say, well, look, if 2008 you could have an agreement on that social grant should at least be in line with the inflation rate, then why can't they honor that now? Why can't they honor that now? So we'd have to look at the validity of that agreement, because there was a broad range of issues over there about food price monitoring and so on. And we'd have to see how far we go towards the implementation of some of those things that were in those agreements. But I think my colleague on my right is going to say much more, I think, from the Chester's perspective on the levels of inequality. So I'm gonna just hand over back to Tony and just say thank you for giving us this opportunity to make a short presentation. Members, good morning, Chair. My name is Keith Vermeulen from the South African Council of Churches Parliamentary Office. The Council of Churches is an integral part of the People's Budget Campaign for the past 10 years now. I'm not going to be speaking on any detail in terms of the presentation. I'm going to be speaking on three or four broad brush strokes of our participation in terms of the importance that the churches regard fiscal and monetary policy of the budget. The churches regard the war on poverty, or poverty and inequality, as a moral challenge and as an ethical challenge to the nation and to the churches as well. The issue of the budget and fiscal policy in addressing poverty is a very real one, and therefore the churches have committed themselves to the People's Budget Campaign, understanding that fiscal policy is probably the most effective policy that can deal with the issue of poverty eradication, and particularly in ensuring that the voice of the poor is heard. In terms of shaping this policy, the churches have committed themselves and continue to commit ourselves to participating in the budget campaign. And just a word on the Moneyville Amendment legislation. The illustration is very clear that we worked with the People's Budget Campaign to see that legislation realized, and so we will commit ourselves and are restructuring ourselves to working within the campaign as well as with the churches to make more effective the participation in shaping the presentation. More about that, obviously, at a later stage. Just two comments. One on fiscal policy. The Council of Churches understands that fiscal policy is a far-reaching, powerful, flexible instrument for poverty eradication, and that government expenditure has the capacity to reach into every crevice of poverty and with a directness and immediacy and with the weapons against poverty that can promise results that no other type of policy can promise or attain. Secondly, the Council of Churches believes that the fiscal policy and the macroeconomic framework should focus on social investment, assets for the poor, the labor intensive, quality livelihoods funded through progressive taxes and prudent borrowing. That's been our position for the last 10 years. We want to affirm that again here this morning. On monetary policy, the Council of Churches believes that the Reserve Bank holds an inordinate high interest rate that is mainly intended to reduce the nation's inflation rate. Our experience and the stories that we have through the poverty hearings now 10 years ago and the ongoing consultations that we have through the Council of Churches with communities is that the poor continue to live in a spiral of poverty. Small, medium enterprises battle for survival. Aspirations for sustainable livelihoods and quality jobs are dampened. Government resources for social investments such as health care, social insurance, assistance, education, skills training are minimized in this high rate trade-off. We believe that monetary policy consistent with support for sustainable livelihoods will not only foster growth but can alleviate the burden carried by the poorest households and communities, but also in the burden that is being carried by government. And those are the broad brush strokes that we believe are important in our moral participation, and I'll hand back to the chair, who will take us through the more detailed presentation that is before us.
Thank you very much, Chair. With your permission, we'd now like to draw your attention to our written submission. Comrade Prakashni from the Conservative Parliamentary Office will take us through the details. Thank you.
Thank you, the Chairman of the Committee, for inviting us to make this submission. I'm going to go straight into the document because I think the introductory statements have been made. So one thing we do want to state upfront and clearly is that obviously what we are measuring the budget against is the principles as listed in the ANC election manifesto, which we believe are the priorities in terms of what would be necessary to take us as far in terms of it, not just addressing the effects of the recession, but as well as the structural components of unemployment poverty and inequality in the country. And these would include the creation of decent work and sustainable livelihoods, education, health, rural development, food security, land reform, and the fight against crime and corruption. And on this basis, we actually are just calling for engagement on the new economic, on the new growth path that the Minister of Finance has indicated, because we actually believe that this is necessary to lay the basis for developing a labor-intensive industry and one that needs to meet the basic needs of our people. Moving on to the actual details of the submission, the first item that we deal with is on fiscal policy. And the issue is obviously broken down into the components between the budget balance and the tax policy proposal, which obviously fall under the revenue proposal. I think the first issue or principle that we want to raise is the question of the measurement of public debt. One, how it's measured, and two, the extent to which it's used as a measurement to reflect on how expansionary the national budget is or isn't. And our concern is that at the outset, we would argue that the measurement of public debt or the deficit, deficit in terms of the budget versus the GDP is not necessarily the exclusive measure to reflect upon how expansionary the budget is. And by way of illustration, and as the admission of by the National Treasury, last year's budget deficit, which escalated to 7.3%, came out largely due to the fact that revenue proposals were significantly lower than the original estimates that were indicated in February, rather than more expansionary budgets. We are also concerned specifically as to how other aspects of monetary policy affect the shaping of the public budget without necessarily being affected by a more expansionary or more broader public spending proposal. And I'm particularly concerned about that is that this ultimately affects government spending, not just on in terms of social delivery, but also in terms of restructuring and transforming the economy to drive to ensure more decent jobs led creative growth. Our view that is in relation to the current fiscal framework and in relation to monetary policy is that the budget is actually biased towards financial investors. Since the gap between the real interest rate and the growth rate of the economy actually plays a more decisive role in determining the dynamics of public debt. And essentially, we've got a vicious cycle. Because when you drive up the interest rate, it also constrains the ability of government to spend more simply because it's going to serve the interest rate. And our main concern is that the budget is focusing on social expenditure, the extent to which this actually affects the public debt, has not actually fully acknowledged the role of interest rates as being a key driver in terms of increasing the ultimate budget debt. So it's the interest rates and the servicing of interest rates that affects public spending, the overall debt, public debt, as opposed to whether or not it's actually influenced by increased spending on particular aspects of social delivery. Further, we're concerned that if you look at the spending proposals in the medium term, you'll find that the deficit is times, and Stephen Ellis in response to actually to rise in revenue. So the idea is that our concern is that if you, one is looking at the deficit in terms of the current proposals as well as in terms of assessing spending proposals in the medium term, a declining deficit does not reflect an expansionary budget. We're also concerned that there aren't exactly complete details as to the extent to which the emphasis that the counter-cyclical response, the detail as to which the deficit has actually been influenced by the counter-cyclical response versus the extent to which the automatic stabilizing the economy has actually influenced the debt. Further, we'd also want to raise particular proposals on taxation, those that are contained in terms of the current budget, as well as new proposals that we want to place on board in terms of actually addressing revenue collection. I think on the whole, what we want to say is that we don't want to push for an unsustainable debt burden. We do believe that we could probably afford a higher deficit, but over and above this, you would have to address the overall framework, the macroeconomic framework, which underpins or influences the deficit without necessarily being influenced by the fact that spending, social and public spending proposals are more expansionary. On tax policy, specifically, we want to speak to corporate tax. We have noted, and I think what we want to indicate is that there is a need for long-term view versus responding to the current economic situation. At the outset, we want to indicate that as a matter of principle, there's a concern that corporate tax has actually declined. There's a disproportionate tax burden on individuals versus companies. And you note that the current corporate tax burden for companies is 136.6 billion as opposed to 224.6 billion for individuals. And this reflects a 3% increase for corporates versus a 13% increase for individuals. Now, we understand that in terms of the current economic situation, we may need to actually moderate proposals in relation to that, but we need to take a longer term view as to what we, how we deal with corporate taxation in the long term in terms of also ensuring a greater redistributive element in the economy. On tax relief, we've noted that the budget makes proposals for tax relief to the amount of $6.5 billion. In principle, we are actually supportive of the implementation of tax relief on the proviso that it's actually targeted towards lower economic groups. And obviously taking into account the impact of the current and ongoing economic situation in the country. What we would also argue for is, and this is a new proposal, is the implementation of a special wealth tax. And we would, currently we're looking at implementing a separate and additional threshold for those who are earning above R1 million, which we've seen that there's an increasing number of people who've actually crossed this threshold. And the additional tax generated from this should obviously be used for relief targeted at lower economic quintiles, whether through direct relief or through social spending. On the proposal specifically to provide the R6.5 billion tax relief to individuals, we note that the argument is made that this is directed at lower economic groups, but I think cognizance needs to be taken of the fact that 46.6% of this benefit is actually going to accrue to people who earn about 250,000. And this group obviously would comprise not necessarily the super wealthy, but at least those who would fall into middle income groups, and this group needs to be tempered more. A further proposal, and this is a new proposal that we want to make, is to reintroduce and reintegrate the debate on the issue of that zero rating. Currently, we've got a list of 18 basic food items. The airlines have the non-food items as well on that list that are zero rated. We believe that this list is too narrow and too basic, and we need to actually review it, first to expand the list foodstuff and everything, but also look at alternative goods as well, such as books, education materials, things for clothing for example, for children and babies. These examples we've noticed have been used in other countries, for example, in the UK. There's also a possibility of us investigating the implementation of not necessarily a death zero rate mechanism, but also reduce that rating for specific goods. And just to point to, if we just by illustration, if we look at the list of basic goods, foodstuffs, the reason why we believe this to be so easy is you've got things like fruits and vegetables that are included in the list. You've got things like dry beans. You don't have any items like canned foods. We're not making a specific proposal, actually, that's never been listed in a revival, so we think there needs to be some discussion around that. If you take an item like dried beans, you have to take into account that this involves an extensive amount of a cooking process that would require electricity, which is an additional economic burden for poor people. So we need to be a bit more creative as to how we actually, as more realistic and practical, but how we implement that zero rating and ensure that it's actually targeted towards poorest income group, especially taking into account that they spend a great portion of their earnings on food. A new proposal as well that we want to place on board is as well to look at reviewing the tax system to ensure or target and reduce the maximum proportional gap between the lowest earning employees and the highest earning, for example, managers in a company. The idea would be to actually address the burgeoning income gap. I mean, we found that this gets statistics. While workers have increasingly received a declining share of profits and GDP, the remuneration packages for senior management have escalated way out of proportion, even with growth in profits and GDP. And this includes the overall total remuneration, not just in terms of basic salary, but includes things like fringe benefits and performance bonuses as well. Further, we also want to look at tax proposals that address issues that have implications for promoting or driving forward our principles on microeconomic policy, and for example, actually promoting and implementing industrial policy that is job-led growth, that reflects job-led growth. And we previously called for the implementation of a tax on non-essential luxury goods. This, obviously, we have to, if you had to implement this, it would not be implemented immediately. You'd have to look at a sectoral strategy in terms of what those non-essential luxury goods would be and ensure that, for example, that valuable input products would not be blocked from entering the economy, entering the country. In relation to the proposals that Treasury makes on the closure of loopholes and expanding the tax base, we actually want to note that we actually strongly support the proposals there. The first and obvious basis for our support is that one, a part of broadening the tax base ensures that we increase revenue to ensure that we can meet our delivery commitments. Two, it also ensures that we have a mechanism to redistribute and ensure greater equality in the country. So we actually look forward to engaging with the details of that. And we also note that specifically under that heading, Treasury also indicated that they wish to engage on the issue in terms of developing proposals on transfer pricing, where we've seen goods and commodities leaving the country, resulting in a massive loss of revenue for the country, and as well as the times we've also compromised the local initiatives to beneficiate and add value and thereby facilitate job creation. So we are looking forward to the details of proposals on transfer pricing as well. On the fuel and environmental taxes, and we've just broadly dealt with this, is that we've noted there are various fuel levies covering one, the cover the increasing inflation. the petroleum pipeline between Durban and Kaohsiung and the Rolex in the final district add a total of 25 cents to the cost of both petrol and diesel. And further, we note that there's to be a new emissions tax that's supposed to impose a new passenger motor vehicles on the 1st of September. And in addition to that, we don't have any dates on that, but there'll be various other taxes that Treasury is also investigating in terms of the carbon tax and environmental taxes, such as wastewater levy and the landfill tax. I'd also be to reiterate that we believe there's an important role in ensuring that we increase tax revenue for the purpose of delivery. We also want to support the principle that we need to take responsibility for promoting more responsible, to be more responsible in terms of how we engage on growth is undertaken in a manner that is consonant with environmental concerns. So our main concern is the timing of these proposals and the implications for the companies that are already under massive strain. And we've already noted previously in terms of our engagements on the carbon tax, on electricity levy, and these were incremental. We need to review the timing of these things. We don't have a fundamental objection to taking responsibility for the impact on the environment. But we think that there needs to be more discussion on this, and we also need to look at alternative mechanisms such as building a capacity to build and develop new technologies that will aid us on a green growth path, rather than just have a punitive measure. Because the question does actually remain, do we have the capacity to actually meet those challenges? And secondly, what's not included here and what was raised by Commissioner Munster is that in some cases, mechanisms are not put into place to ensure that people can actually take responsibility for reducing carbon emissions. And this includes, for example, that we manufacture cars automatically for export with catalytic converters, which reduces carbon emissions. But that's not a formal policy in terms of manufacturing cars locally. And if we have to introduce a sectoral mechanism like that, not only would it reduce carbon emissions, but that would also obviously have a job creation potential as well. On the question of monetary policy and inflation targeting, it's always clear that we raise concerns about the monetary policy and inflation targeting in relation to interest rates. We note the new mandate that the minister has communicated to the Reserve Bank, which has been argued as reflected as a more flexible mandate. But we argue that in reality this does not translate into much, and that the Reserve Bank technically always has this flexibility. And that essentially what we need to look at is not so much a flexible mandate, but a broader mandate that actually targets employment, rather than the question of price stability. I'm not going to go into the details though, because we have spoken to that before. But broadly, what we say is that we reiterate the call to scrap inflation targeting. We believe that this is the underlying cause for the persistently high unemployment rate, the strong exchange rate that we currently have, and essentially underpins the industrialization of our economy and the imbalances that we continue to experience, for example, in relation to our current account deficit. Then we turn to specific proposals listed in the budget speech and the review. We haven't asked anything, but there's certain, obviously, the details and more on a wider range of issues we will be engaging with in terms of the individual budget vote and in terms of the division of revenue vote, but we've picked on select aspects which we think we need to actually deal with in this process. On youth unemployment, our main concern at the outset that we need to indicate is that there is no real coherent and comprehensive employment policy that we have in place. And what we need to note is that by selecting certain sections of the population, we we don't actually deal with the structural elements of unemployment in the country. The fact is, first and foremost, is that the youth are... I think first and foremost, the youth cannot be unaffected by the fact that unemployment is a structural component in our country. Obviously, being amongst the most marginal in economy, they would be most directly affected, most seriously affected. But we have to. We're concerned that the proposals in place wouldn't actually address those aspects that actually makes them the most vulnerable to structural components of employment. In fact, what it actually seeks to do is institutionalize and entrench a two-tier labor market. And this is first in terms of the youth subsidy, and secondly in terms of the regulatory aspects that it proposes to introduce, such as a minimum wage separate and distinct for youth workers, as well as to a separate labor regulation regime in terms of doing probation for youth workers. One of the arguments made for introducing the subsidy and also the minimum wage is the argument that productivity has not stepped up or is not in line with real wage growth. And we've seen statistics reflected from emerging countries and in some other countries that have very poor labor practices. And this is not the most correct measure to actually look at productivity. Secondly, we don't see where there's evidence that it's young people's wages specifically that have been rising faster than their productivity that have kept them out of the labour market. And finally, I think we just need to assess or state quite clearly that the principle of decent work and decent work for all means decent work for all people in the population, not decent work for some and substandard regulation and implementation for younger workers. We are at the same time actually happy to engage with the issue of how we actually draw in youth workers into the economy. We'd also want to look at, for example, looking at how Employment Equity Act can actually address this, things like that. Also, but more specifically, we want to look at those structural aspects of structural social aspects that actually preclude young workers from entering the labour market. And specifically here, you want to indicate something, is that it's not all young workers that have difficulty entering the labour market. Aspects such as economic class, race, directly influence that, which actually, if you look at, which overlaps the question of access to opportunities. The budget itself refers to a 48% rate of unemployment for youth, and they list the ages from 15 to 24. And just at the outset, the principle of social consciousness, we need to ask the question, do we really want workers between the ages of 15 and 18 to be working, or do we want them to actually be setting down the foundation for them to enter the labor market at a different level? Because if we want them to enter the labor market and we consider someone between 15 and 18, to be capable of entering the labour market rather than completing schooling, then it means that they're actually calling for a different dispensation for poorer and often more likely black workers, young workers and other workers. Because you'll find that in most cases, the children of middle class and above are during that age and actually older, accessing opportunities high school and obviously post high school and tertiary level, trying to lay down the foundation for accessing the labor market with skills. If you lock workers, young workers, into the labor market at a younger age without equipping them with the necessary skills, what you end up doing is trapping them and into a cycle of poverty. And I think we really need to review even our technical definitions of youth unemployment on that basis. On public health, we note that Well, the principal has maintained that government is working to prepare the grant for national health insurance. We were unable to pick up any direct indication of the initial foundations of this in the budget process, because obviously we would see some introductory elements of that, and we are actually concerned about that. Instead, what we've seen is a broadening of the use of public-private partnerships in the health sector. And just at the outset, we want to indicate that we are actually opposed to the use of public-private partnerships in terms of delivery of a very important social service. Further, we are concerned that the minister has already indicated that there will be an increase in the cap for the monthly deductible medical schemes contributions. This is in relation to benefiting from PEP. This, we believe, is actually contrary to the attempt to facilitate expansion of entry into medical schemes, and also would also target even lower income earners. We're concerned that rather that this should be direct, that there should be more towards move towards implementation of the National Health Insurance Scheme rather than expanding the usage of the larger medical aid schemes, which are in terms of delivering a broader comprehensive range of public health or access to health care, hence eventually exclusionary. Because you'll find that in implementation of those of medical schemes for the lower end of the market, they place limitations on the number of visits you can make to a GP or even services that you can access at the country level in a hospital. On social security, my colleagues have already raised the issue in terms of the problems with the minimal amount implemented for social grants. And just to note on this issue that for years, especially during the GEAR era, we had no increases, particularly for the child support grant, and that even after the increases were implemented, this was at below inflation. And what is important to note is that more than any other form of aid, income support for poor households has the most direct and most significant impact in actually reducing that. A major problem, and not so much a question of irregularity, but a major problem is that these grants are not just dependent on by the individuals who receive them. They're often dependent on by entire households, because unemployment tends to plague a household as a whole, and not just individuals. On corruption, we would like to indicate that we actually support the council line indicated by the minister, and as well as on the minister's proposal to look at implementing the recommendations that came out of the Competition Commission on Banking and the Banking Inquiry. Thank you.
Thank you. I could say first that you were trying to work as fast as you could, but I think the submission is here. When we interact with your input, we'll also refer to the document. You spoke to the document, you didn't read through it, which was quite helpful in terms of time. And we are very much alert to the fact that these are very, very emotive issues as we're discussing here. In terms of our assistance, we had planned that we'll take the two submissions together, and the honorable members will then be able to interact later on without any sequence. We'll just ask questions, comments, and then we'll take the photo forward. The next presentation will come from Business Unity, South Africa.
Chair, would you like us to move to the front?
Normally you leave from the front.
Okay. Chair, while my colleagues take their seats, I would just like to use the opportunity for the benefit of the members of the Select Committee who don't think we've appeared before yet. To just in addition to the more extensive background that's given in as an introduction to our document, just say that as the EPIC business organization in the country, we've got about 85% of business under our membership. And just to correct the common misperception that ABUSA, through its constituent federated chambers, also extensively represents small business and not only big business. Today, we have Professor Raymond Parsons, who's the Deputy CEO and one of our foremost economists in the country. Simi Suwiso is the Economic Policy Director of BUSA. My name is Kunal Pasejnes. I head the Business Parliamentary Office, or the BUSA Parliamentary Office, as it's now known. My colleagues have a particular view of Castanian work ethic, and them being from Johannesburg and it being Friday, insisted that they handle the presentation. So, with your permission, go to the mail for me.
Thank you, Chair, and members of the committee, for this opportunity for me to submit some news to you. You have the document, and I think perhaps the quality time will come from the question and answer session rather than a lengthy presentation on our part. So, let me perhaps take the opportunity, Chair, at the outset just to lift out some of the main points of our document between myself and Team Sunita, and then we will be happy to field any questions. I think, Chair and members of the committee, the important point here for business when it contemplated the budget was really under three main headings. The first was to test it for its policy certainty and predictability. Secondly, to look at the fiscal framework, what goals, what it's seeking to achieve, and did strike the right balance. And thirdly, the budget deficit itself, not only the quantity, but the quality. Otherwise, it might be a simple pyramid. So I think the important point here is that we would approach the budget with those three important points in mind. And our view is, as it has been indicated in the document, Chair, that a skillful balance has been struck of prioritizing economic growth, jobs, job creation, and poverty eradication in the budget, given the very difficult circumstances, both externally and internally, within which the National Treasury has to reconcile the fiscal deficit with the social deficit. We certainly have identified in the fiscal strategy a counter-cyclical approach, which is absolutely necessary given the recession which we have experienced, as well as also looking ahead and laying the foundations to plan for future growth. When we look at the business cycle, we think also that the budget speech has identified where we are in the business cycle. We are slowly coming out of the recession. And you will have seen some of the better economic news of the last few days. Nonetheless, we believe, as does the Minister of Finance, that this recovery does remain fragile and indeed vulnerable, both from an internal and an external point of view. We see the table being laid, we hear the plates being rattled, we have smells from the kitchen, but the meal has not yet been served. So, against that background, Chair, we as business feel that the deficit of 7.3% is part of the counter-cyclical approach, and it's very important for us to also recognize, as I said earlier, it's not only the quantity of that deficit, but also its quality. And one important point we need perhaps to underscore, having looked at the budget itself, is the importance in the years ahead to bring the public sector wage bill under control. It's over 30% of the budget, and it has been rising at an annual rate of about 70% over the past 3 years. The current budget arrives does allow for 7% over the next 3 years, and it's very important that we adhere to that guideline, because if that gets out of control, it will squeeze other more desirable forms of spending. The other point we'd like to emphasize is that we do share the economic forecast that was reflected in the budget, that probably we'll grow roughly 2.5% this year.
in the aftermath of the session, bearing in mind that last year it was more or less minus two, so by the end of this year we'll be no further than we were a year ago. But this coincides with forecasts which Bursa has made, and we think that that's a fairly reliable forecast for the next year or so, perhaps rising to 3.5% in the year thereafter. I think the message that comes through to business and I think to other stakeholders is the need to get this economy onto a higher growth path and to maximize the number of jobs that can be created at any given growth rate. Here we support the proposal for, that we should address very specifically within the unemployment challenge, the issue of youth unemployment, and that we support the principle of the wage subsidy instrument, but there needs to be further consultation as to how it might actually work in practice. The important message that comes through to us, Chair, in the budget is we have to also, apart from stabilizing the economy, look beyond the recession and look to the years ahead. We believe certainly if we can get our act together in the next couple of years, we should be able, if we can, to average a growth rate. If we want to double the economy by 2025, double the size of the economy, which will make all sorts of other things possible, we should be able to average growth rates of about 5% between now and then. Otherwise, we will not be able to double the size of our economy over that period. Just a couple of elements to come back to the issue which I mentioned up front, Chair, in regard to certainty and predictability in the policy environment, which is very important for decision making, especially in the private sector. The two elements here which we would simply identify with, the first was the comments by the Minister of Finance in regard to the exchange rate. We support the principle of leaning against the wind. We believe it in a flexible exchange rate management regime, and we support a leaning against the wind approach. We are pleased this has been publicly acknowledged, and that the methods by which this could be done have also been identified in the budget. We like to make the point we cannot have asymmetrical credibility here. If the rand has been falling by as much as it's been rising, we have had 1,000 voices going up as to what we should do about it. Now, when it's rising, all of a sudden some people pretend we are helpless, which we're not. There are limited things we can do, but we must at least recognize that as and when necessary, it is possible to access policy tools which could make that leaning against the wind possible. On inflation targeting, we support the approach outlined in the budget speech of a flexible but a consistent approach to inflation targeting. Even those who are highly critical of inflation targeting would have to accept that the central bank has to target inflation, whether it does through that particular mechanism or in some other way. The fact is that low inflation is good for the poor and good for financial stability. So we do need a credible anchor through inflation targeting for monetary policy and a reliable yardstick for future interest rate policy to guide business and the market. But there is actually no reason why we cannot engage in a constructive way in a debate. We've had inflation targeting for a decade, and we can learn from it, and we can see how it can be improved, if indeed that is, from a technical point of view, necessary. So, Chair, I would say that in the process of just speaking very broadly and in broad brush strokes, we endorse the broad approach of the budget. That doesn't mean to say we applaud everything in it, but we certainly welcome the broad approach, and particularly the commitment that we all have to get this economy onto a higher growth path. We really have to do better than the 3.5%, or at least the 3.6% that is predicated for 2011. We know that growth is not an end in itself, it's a means to an end. And if we can double this economy over the next 15 years, we will achieve a great deal and get more positive outcomes. The other point which we'd just like to also make is that we support the appeal by the Minister that This is a collective responsibility. All stakeholders have to come to the party so that we can translate the broad opportunities that might be created by what we do over the next few years to send a message out to the world that South Africa is open for business in the post-recession period. That we will build on the achievements and the opportunities of the Soccer World Cup this year to lay the foundations to ensure that we do get higher growth, more jobs, and less poverty in the years ahead. So, in conclusion, Chair, in terms of these broad brush assessments, our approach is very much that this budget must be seen as laying the foundations, not only to stabilize our economy in the next few years, but also to lay foundations for growth. In that context, we think it is important that over time we wind down the fiscal deficit over time. For that, we actually need to grow out of the deficit. That, in effect, is what we need to do. We need to grow the tax base, not the salt tax, in order that we can afford to do the social things that have to be done through redistribution and through fiscal redistribution. Also, on the infrastructural side, there are important developments there which are supporting growth and employment, and we in the private sector are certainly committed to ensuring that whatever delivery is needed to make that infrastructural development work for the general good will indeed take place. Chair, with those general comments, I'm going to ask my colleague, Ms. Felice, if she will just add one or two other points.
Thank you, Chairperson.
And
honourable members, I think I'll make my contributions in the area of tax and the use of tax to support economic development. And secondly, I'll make broad remarks on expenditure priorities. As a business organization, we are obviously increasingly concerned about the use of tax and special levies to raise additional revenue. This is in particular because there is a macroeconomic link between tax levels and the efficiency of the tax system and investment decisions. We believe that the tax policy should be used to support investment and growth. So we need to give incentives for both domestic and international businesses to invest in our economy, for us to broaden our tax base, to create jobs, and overall to have higher economic growth to achieve the problems of poverty and unemployment. In addition, the debate on climate change taxes, we are inclined to agree with our colleagues from Conservative. We believe that the debate is necessary, however, the timing of the debate will be crucial. We've got many businesses struggling to survive in the aftermath of the global crisis. Now, to simply suggest that we would have additional taxes imposed on business, whilst many of them have limited ability to transfer from coal financed electricity, which is a bulk emitter, to other cleaner energy, is really at this point premature. We believe that our energy industry is a key contributor to our climate change emissions, and therefore any discussions on climate change taxes should seek to actually deregulate the electricity and energy market. In this regard, we would call for greater consultation on the climate change taxes. This should be aligned to our Copenhagen commitment, and we urge the time that there is greater consultation with business on the design and the timing of such tax. On the additional levies that are being proposed, we again agree that this can actually put further pressure on business, on communities, and the general economy at large. We would be keen to see what the displacement effect would be of the additional levies, and whether or not it wouldn't be counterproductive at this stage to introduce them whilst we're trying to aim for higher economic growth. On expense priorities, I think we as an organization are broadly supportive of the priorities identified in the budget. But honourable members, you might recall last year when we were here, we should appeal for efficiency in government spending. We believe that this remains the most critical part in ensuring that our budget has the desired outcomes. As the participate is not the size of the deficit that the net has, but rather the quality of our deficit. How are we spending the money? What are our outcomes from our health investment, education, and all the other priorities that are correctly identified in the budget? We believe that the debate should really move away from the macro allocations to the micro challenges that continue to be a critical construction in ensuring service delivery. But generally, the focus on social infrastructure and social investment is appropriate. It's reflective of our society and some of the structural issues that we face. But we also believe that the budget structure skillful balance between social investment and public infrastructure. So, of course, we do support the target. However, we're keen to see how the monitoring mechanisms will work. And we believe that it is the role of this committee and members around the table to ensure that the outcomes from the budget are satisfactory. We believe that this committee has to ensure that its department is accountable, not just to Parliament, but to the broader development society. And we look forward to hearing how the committee will work with national policy in ensuring that on industrial development financing, Bruce is currently reviewing the Industrial Policy Action Plan. We welcome, at this stage, the 3.6 billion rand allocation for industrial policy. However, we believe that there is critical information missing in terms of how that will be rolled out, how we will measure progress. We do recall that the Industrial Policy Action Plan for 2007-2008, we didn't have a thorough review before the new version was published. We believe that that could have been very, very useful in assisting us to develop an Industrial Policy Action Plan that is workable. But generally, as a principle, we believe that it is more optimal for South Africa to reduce the overall cost of doing business, meaning focus on improving competitiveness, rather than by targeting specific sectors. However, we will review the documentation and we will make our submissions in this regard. And finally, on the work on corruption, as an organization, we're currently the chair of the National Anti-Corruption Forum, and we will be doing significant work in strengthening the ability of business to support government in fighting corruption. And we urge all the members around the table to ensure that they also promote anti-corruption initiatives within their own ranks. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you very much. Honorable members, you have had the true submission. It's now time for you to engage in the true submission. Floor set 1, 2 from Kajal, followed by Harris, and Gordon Hoff. And then Brazil will be followed by Hoshima Chile and then the end. In that order. You will all recall.
Thank you, Chair President. Actually, the first question is for you, Chair President. Where is your teacher? But you can answer that one later. Thank you very much for the presentation. Very interesting as usual. To Bruza, it's very pleasing to see that you're working together with government to fight corruption because that's very important, and we look forward to seeing your report on that eventually. On broadening the tax base, there is a view that there are tax cash businesses in South Africa that are not paying their fair share of tax. So what is business as an organization doing to get the cash business into the tax net? And then also, is there anything on the fiscal framework that you would want to change? And if it is, what would it be? And then for Kasatu, you raised this issue about inflation targets the last time you were here. And I think I remember asking the question about what would your alternative be? If it wasn't inflation targeting, how would we manage inflation? Because I hope I understand what you're saying, that inflation is not a good thing. Inflation does need to be managed because it actually impacts on the poor the most. So how would we actually do that? Then on page number 6 you mentioned that the tax regime, especially VAT, I could not agree with you more regarding this issue about VAT. There is a need for us to have a look at the regime applicable certainly one of my recommendations as a member of this committee to this committee is going to be that we do need to actually start some kind of process where we start looking at the tax regime applicable to South Africa, especially that. Then, what is COSATU doing about improving productivity? You mentioned economic growth, but that's vital. And then you mentioned the higher deficit, and at the same time you mentioned that we need to manage debt. How are we actually going to do that? How will we fund the deficit then if it's getting bigger and we need to manage debt? Obviously, there is a way to do that through private investments into private sectors, which would invest in efficiencies into them, and it would improve the fiscal framework, and it would free up resources for other imperatives. So is that not the solution? And then on the national health insurance, apparently it will cost about 240 billion rand to implement a system like that. How would it actually be funded given the resources? Thank you, Chairperson.
Firstly, in relation to the comments I made at the end of yesterday, I'd like just like to say both of these presentations were excellent. They both had concrete proposals that we can engage with and either accept or adopt when we amend the budget. So congratulations to both teams. To brief up first, the proposal, I think you're suggesting in the environmental tax area that any revenues from carbon taxes should be ring-fenced. Does that mean that the brief in general supports the principle that the tax of ring fencing taxes? Can you give a bit more detail around a firm proposal that seems to be missing from your presentation, even though it was noted? And then you both presentations speak about structural issues in the labour market. Or rather, I mean, I think we have talked about structural unemployment, but that means structural issues in the labour market. Bruce refers to underlying issues in the labour market. Now, for both, I'd like both teams to comment on this. Because if the labour market is an interaction between the demand for labour and the supply of labour, and the fact that it moves is your price of labour, which in this case is really the important factor because of productivity, which is how much you're producing price over time, output over price. If you accept my analysis there, what are both of your, when you say structural problems in this market, what are the problems with that interaction, and how do you resolve them? Because I think both presentations mention these structural issues, but neither unpack them and get to the crux of the matter. And then to, again, both teams, but Kisati went into it in a bit more detail, or rather the people's budget went into it in a bit more detail. The response to the recession. I happen to agree, or at least have sympathy for your analysis on page 4, that it is not clear whether the deficit we observe is due mainly to automatic stabilizers or the stimulus package. I mean, that raises a whole question. Now that we are out of the recession, if we experience an external shock that causes a recession in South Africa again, how do we use the system to deal with that? Now, obviously, the Treasury is stating that they use countercyclical expenditure to spend our way out of it. I probably have sympathy with Kosati's view here. But aside from that, they also introduced a set of distinct measures. The key one was the training layoff subsidy scheme. Now that had, it's not a significant cost in the system, but just, I would appreciate your analysis on whether that scheme works and whether in future we could potentially have spent more money on something like that. And how do you explain the fact that, I think it was 37 firms, something that applied for the 6 billion rand that we put aside for that training layoff scheme. That's it.
Thank you. Thank you, Chairperson. I think both presenters can comment on what I'm trying to ask. If you look at the IMF Emerging Marketing Monitor, South Africa is not doing well. About approximately 20 countries. You know, on growth, inflation, the budget deficit, the fiscal deficit, the current account and forex reserves, we are worse or unattractive. Now, I just want to, and on interest rates, we're better or a little bit more attractive. That's the only sort of field where we stand up. Now, what I want to ask, if you look at the comparison between inflation rate and short-term interest, if you compare China, now China's got many other problems and many other good things, but they've got inflation very closely linked to short-term interest rates, both roughly at 2%. If you look at India, India's got a good growth, but they've got inflation of about 14% and interest rates of about 4%. So there is a sort of a link, low interest rate, high growth, but high inflation. If you look at South Africa, it's very similar. Inflation rates and short-term interest rates are fairly close to each other. But if you look at all this in the emerging market, they link inflation rate with short-term interest rates fairly. India is different, and Venezuela is highest in interest rates and highest in inflation. So what I want to ask, what will be a fair inflation target for Zimbabwe? And if you think it is between 6% and 8% or between 8% and 10%, how will you achieve lower interest rates to create the growth you think will be linked to interest rates? And then finally, the whole world is in a sort of a debt crisis. Everybody is looking to the market, and it's tough to get credit. Now, there are countries that are struggling, and they will go to market soon, and they are already in the market trying to pay their deficits. Now, South Africa will also go then. So will the SOEs go. And eventually, if we do get growth, the spending patterns of individuals will start to change, and they will go to the market. So how are we going to control interest rates in fact in market?
Thank you, Chairperson. Two questions. My question on the people's budget quality. On page 11, you indicate there that there is some semblance probably of opposition to the PPP. And you are giving an example here of state involvement in the private sector in the VARA project. And I'm not quite sure the extent to which the research from NEHAU is projecting with respect to the findings on the PPP. But you see, with ordinary people, they are just looking at the end product. You know, far as the extent to which it has improved because of that particular partnership. Now, I'm not quite sure also if you could be able to explain the problems in terms of the partnerships that government is establishing with business. My question to Busa is, with respect to the issues raised by the coalition, I would like to find out what your comment is on their tax relief strategy. With respect to their proposal that there should be a zero rating on basic foodstuffs and books and clothes for babies. And they also raised a very interesting issue here. The time, you know, the time taken to cook therapy and the extent to which that impacts on the usage of electricity. So, just a comment from you, sir.
Chairperson. I think I was the only four questions. Starting with Musa, just to hear from them the non-committal of financial resources to fund the introduction of the national health insurance. What is their view? What is their comment on that? And the second one is that through the presentation of Musa, it looks like they are supportive of the many interventions that government is making in the economy. But on one side, it looks like there is a commitment to advocate for deregulation of business. And I think of late, the recent statement also talking about deregulating the energy sector. I just want them to talk to that, to the two, whether they don't advocate deregulation when it suits them, and they support interventions of government when it suits them as well. And then with the COSATU and related organizations, in most of their comments, one really agrees with them. But what I just want them to talk to is on the issue of the under 21 that find themselves in the labor market. We do agree with them that we definitely need to limit the under 21 from entering the labor market. But the question that they need to talk to is, what do we do with the current crop of under 21 that are on the streets, on different places, and they cannot go back to school, and they are a consequence of the past economic activities, and also the a consequence of the past apartheid government. Now they find themselves in the streets as we're speaking now. What do we do? How do they see us getting out of that particular problem? There will be also on the issue of introducing the 1 million threshold on the tax burden. I just want to know whether they have done some calculations and what are the indications of revenue that can be generated. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you, Chair. Chair, I appreciate the view from Musa in relation to the cooperation and commitment on the part of assisting government in fighting corruption and also the monitoring and the evaluation of government activity. The question that I want to pose to them around emissions on climate change, is there any commitment or maybe pre-commitment even before South Africa commits itself to the globe in relation to the elimination of emissions? Because in Africa, South Africa is the best emitting country. Then the other issue, Chair, is is in relation with the price instability. COSATU is crying foul of price stability, of which Musa has a role. stability in prices by controlling the behavior of business in terms of ensuring that there is stability in prices. Even in the procurement policies of government, where government seeks to accommodate more people through business, but the issue of pricing by contractors, it is left much to be desired. Service providers, which I think they fall within business, where a can of Coca-Cola is sold for 15 rand, I mean, that is not a good practice in terms of ensuring sustainability on the part of government to utilize business. Then and also the issue of job losses. Are you able to determine as to what percentage does business contribute in the entire job losses in the country? Because there is within government some retention policies, but in terms of business, even in the banks, it's so rare if you can find someone who has been working in the bank for over 10 years. After 2 or 3 years, someone who is working in the bank will say, no, I'm looking for an alternative job. So if business has a role that is playing in terms of increasing the number of the unemployed, then only two questions to COSATU. COSATU around the 846 billion, which is dedicated to infrastructure. They are concerned about the use of the state-owned enterprises, of which I think the government has opted for that approach of utilizing state-owned enterprises. That's because of the corruption and the price issue. And it goes back to Busa. Then COSATU, instead of engaging Busa, is throwing stones at government. The government is trying hard to ensure that corruption actually limited by all means. And also the issue of creation of informal jobs. The informal jobs that COSATU has alluded to, most of them are aspects where government want to train and engage as an entry to the work situation of those that are coming from school. So COSATU must try and be clear on this, because on the other side, our children that are coming out of school, they don't get employed either by business and government because of the experience of which these learnerships and these expanded public work programs of government is to ensure that there is some that is gained by the individual that are graduating from school. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. As I welcome the two my presentation, I think I'm interested to know, as cited by one of the presenters from the People's Budget Coalition, I will avoid, obviously, maybe singling out an individual participant in the coalition, because this might overshadow other stakeholders in the coalition. So I will refer to, and I hope that they have a collective ownership of submissions made by individual members as part of the broader coalition. There was an indication that
earlier on, that the Gini coefficient is gets worsened. And then this has been obviously been compared with during the apartheid situation. It has, according to the statement, I mean, the inequalities are far worse than they were, I mean, during the apartheid era. I'm very much interested, this maybe there is a study that has been conducted by the PBC. We'll be giving that particular information, but also if there are sources of such, can we be referred to such sources so as we are able to follow on this matter appropriately? Thank you very much.
You are a veteran, I can't deny you. Okay, but then.
Thank you. I appreciate the stance that is taken by this to say that they are going to assist government to fight corruption. Now, the form of corruption that worries us also is the one that takes place in the coalitions amongst companies when they fix prices. Now, most of the time, the discovery would be made by the competition board. And sometimes, obviously, it could be one of the three or four companies that blows the whistle. But I would like to find out what is Busa's relationship with the competition board and also whether Busa has got whistleblower. Thank you.
Who wants to take a bite first? Go back to Busa. It doesn't matter.
And a formidable list of questions from the members of this committee. The more taxing questions, literally and figuratively, I will refer to Simi Samisa, the taxation, the environmental tax, the issue of the national health scheme, and corruption. I'll also deal with, and I'll deal with the other. Firstly, on the fiscal framework, Chair, I think we must remind ourselves that certainly from the Busa point of view, we wanted a largely supplier-free budget with no shock. And that, of course, was promised by the fact that the budget itself was preceded by the medium-term expenditure framework, which we think is a very sound framework. It gives everyone an opportunity to see how fiscal strategies will unfold and how the expenditure framework will unfold over the next 3 years. At the same time, it provides one with an opportunity to engage year by year with some of the decisions that indeed flow from that framework. So by and large, I think from the business point of view, we are broadly satisfied with the soundness of that framework. We would just perhaps again say that there are a number of policy decisions that lie outside the fiscal framework and for which you cannot look for answers within the budget or the budget speech. And I think some of those issues have already been touched upon in certain of the questions that have been raised. In regard to the structural issues around the labour market, I think the important point here is, and I think this is quite an important document which will help the committee if it is active, if it is a public document. It is the progress report to President Jacob Zuma on the implementation of the framework for South Africa's response to the global crisis. Now, I think the problem is we move on, events move on, and we forget of the work that was done collaboratively by government, labour, business, and the community over the last year to put together and to support various proposals to offset the shock of the recession. And some of them did touch on some structural issues. And I suppose this is going to be one of the unsung heroes of our recovery, because, you know, I think people will say, well, it's due to recovery in the global economy or it's due to something else. But I think the fact is that some of these measures, not all, some of these measures certainly over the year began to contribute towards rebuilding confidence and beginning to implement certain specific measures. Also supporting measures that were already in the pipeline and would therefore command credibility from the stakeholders. I just want to get to the issue of the training layoff. Just read from this document, because this was one of the big ticket items which was in this framework document. And I just want to draw your attention to this one point here about the training layoff. South Africa has introduced its first ever training scheme aimed at providing companies with an alternative to retrenching workers during a period of industrial collapse caused by the recession. The scheme has been put together in record time, design, budgeting, and the allocation of funding is complete. That's correct. But there has been some delay in actually rolling it out for various reasons, certain logistical reasons. There first had to be a pilot project towards the end of last year, but there are more applications have been coming in, and the CCMA has been able to report more positively on the extent to which that scheme has been helpful in seeking to cushion some of the worst effects of the job retention. Also part of this process was an appeal that went out from business leaders to the CEOs of companies, once again underscoring the message that retrenchment should be the last resort. And I think this was well received by the business community. There's really no reason to think that businessmen particularly want to retrench unless compelled by circumstances beyond their control. So I think on the issue of the labour market, trying to make it work better, there are some steps, as I say, in this progress report, which have been implemented. And in fact, the date of this report is the first week of December of last year. And in fact, I would certainly urge that members of the committee access this report as part of their assessment of what are some of the fiscal implications of what was agreed to here, and which have been reflected both early on in the medium-term expenditure framework, which preceded this report, and subsequently in the main budget recently. The other issue on rates between inflation and interest rates, that's a very complex area. I suppose one must start from the premise that in the long run there is no trade-off between inflation and that in the long term low inflation is good for an economy. From many points of view, not least of all its impact on the poor. But of course in the real world there are trade-offs. And the big debate, of course, here in South Africa is what should the trade-off be? We decided it was not a Reserve Bank decision, I should emphasize, it's a cabinet decision to set the range for the inflation target of 3-6%. The central bank has got operational independence. It implements the target set by the cabinet. And we decided it should be 3-6%. And that's been reaffirmed in the budget. Now, there can be a debate. Some people may say if you're growing at 6%, then 6% inflation is fine. That's a good bargain. But if you're only growing at 2%, if you have 6% inflation, maybe that's not such a good bargain. So I think these are issues that are part of the trade-off debate and for which there's always some room for a difference of opinion. All we can say is that the target we're operating under at the moment is the target to which the Reserve Bank is committed, and that target has been set by the Cabinet on the basis that low inflation over the long term is good for South Africa and for a country. The other issue I'd like to touch upon is the issue of VAT. Now, I think that's the point of departure for business here, once again, is that if we want to give social assistance, it's so much better that it is targeted and visible, and that you don't help people who don't need to be helped. And I think the whole problem with VAT exemptions is that many of us in this room enjoy those exemptions. In fact, we don't deserve it. So certainly from a business point of view, and we think certainly from a fiscal point of view, there's a lot more to be said. You can evolve a system whereby you can target interviews that you wish to help, and you know how much it's going to cost, and you can review that from time to time. One proposal has been that perhaps one has reached a stage where one might have to contemplate the advantages and the disadvantages of a food stamp system, which is very targeted, and the one striking example in the United States is one that's working very successfully, and it's very interesting to see that in the current recessionary circumstances, or in the last year or so, the extent to which the use of food stamps has increased, and it's very targeted, and it helps those who need to be helped. So certainly, we would prefer more direct and targeted assistance rather than to corrode the tax base any further. We would prefer to, as far as possible, keep the integrity of the tax base intact. The only other issue I think that I'd like to deal with is in regard, Chair, to the issue of the Competition Commission, or what you may want to add to it. We certainly engaged with the Competition Commission. We have sent the message out quite clearly that the collusive pricing is condemned by BUSA, that if you believe in an enterprise-driven economy, then you must have competition, and that we need the work of the Competition Commission to succeed, and that we, where there isn't enough competition, we should encourage it. In fact, a number of the surveys, you will recall, Chair, that you know, we seem to think that that the events of the last 12 months were unique. But in fact, if some of you go back a few years, say 2 years, you recall we were already debating in this chamber why was the South African economy slowing down? And what could we do to get back to the 5% that we were had experienced between 2005 and 2006. And so we were engaged, and we were then already interrogating the factors that needed to get this economy back onto a higher growth path. We were heading for what we call a soft landing. What the global crisis is, was to turn the soft landing into a hard landing, with all the consequences. So we really have to, in fact, renew that debate and identify those factors that, indeed, the Minister of Finance has said are needed to get us onto that higher growth path. An important part that came out of then already, the studies that were done, and through ESPISA, one of the top of the six priorities and constraints was we needed more competition in this economy, and we need to take steps to ensure that that happened. That was the most serviceable instrument that you could look to. And indeed, when you come back, and this has caught up with us now again, with the whole debate about ESCOM, when obviously one of the big issues is that we can no longer put all our eggs into the ESCOM basket. So I think from the competition point of view, certainly BUSA, as an organization that believes in an enterprise-driven economy, believes that a competition is an essential element for a successfully enterprising economy. Now, if I may, Chair, ask Tini to address the other issues of tax and of corruption and climate change, which were raised by some of the other members of the committee.
Thank you. The first question that
I'd
ask was, how are we influencing tax businesses to comply with tax policy? I think our view as an organization in this matter is that a well administered tax regime does assist in our work in advocating for compliance with tax law. In this regard, we work closely with our members from the Chamber movement who much closer to the cash based businesses to ensure that there is compliance with tax policy in general. We do have a tax committee at BUSA that looks at various issues of tax policy and see how we can improve our efforts in that regard. And then the second question was around carbon taxes and whether or not we believe that carbon taxes should be ring-fenced. I think our view there is really influenced by the basic purpose behind carbon taxes. Our understanding is that carbon taxes are there to assist with climate change issues and to mitigate against the climate change challenge. Now, if we use those taxes for something else, we will be caught in a situation whereby we've raised the revenue, but we haven't delivered on our climate change obligations. Therefore, on this particular issue, we are quite clear. Environmental taxes should be used to support environmentally responsible business and also adjusting our economy to be able to deal with the pressure that climate change will put in our development. The third question was on corruption and what we are doing on trying to deter corruptive practices in the private sector. As we previously mentioned, we are currently carrying the National Anti-Corruption Forum. Our work there is in various streams, but one of the important areas that BUSA has been engaged in as far as I say is conviction law. We certainly realize that collusion and contravention of the Competition Act is indeed does amount to corruption. So as early as 2008, we've been involved and we work closely with the Competition Commission. Last year, what we've agreed to do is to set up what we call a business consultative forum on competition policy. What that seeks to do is to advocate and create a platform for engagement to the Competition Commission and BUSA. That project has two distinct arms. One is really a competition advocacy program, whereby we do encourage our members, we communicate with them on relevant issues that are emanating from competition law. But the other arm really relates to information and ensuring that our members are clear about what the law requires of them. But certainly, as Mr. Parker said, we as a free market organization believe that competition is integral to economic development. So we are committed to working with all the relevant organizations to support competition in the economy. The third question that was asked of us is on the issue of the national health insurance and the allocations in the budget. I think in our view, we would have been disappointed if government hadn't allocated money for healthcare. That would have been a big problem. However, as an organization, we haven't seen government policy on NHI. It would have been putting the cart before the horse if we were to allocate money for a program where there is no government policy, as far as we know, as an organization. Certainly, if there is a government policy that is tabled and canvassed thoroughly across all stakeholders, we would therefore expect that sometime there would be an allocation. But I think that today, mental health insurance must really be broadened to include available research. If there is a government data, every organization will look forward to reviewing it and providing our input. But in addition to that, the debate on national health insurance requires that we actually first ensure that even the public health system is performing better than it is at the moment. You can't address a national problem just by providing funding without resolving the issues on efficiency, performance, and the relevant organizational issues that need to be addressed. On our requirement for deregulation of the energy sector, I think Honorable Mashibe raised concerns that we tend to pick and choose what we want to support. I think Honorable Mashibe, our position is simple. If we believe that what is proposed by government is good for this economy, we will support that. It is not selective choices, but rather we do our own analysis and say, does it make sense to adopt a certain policy of government? So certainly from time to time we'll agree with government, but we will also use our rights to disagree with government if that affects economic growth and the ability of our members to contribute to the society. And I think those were all the questions that we asked of us.
Yes, there are perhaps two issues where I'd like to weigh in with the permission of my colleagues. I think the one you requested on the labour issue. These two things. So one question on broadening the tax base. I would just like to offer this. The type of businesses that do not subject themselves to regulation, i.e. tax businesses or informal businesses, are quite often not the type of business who has membership to a business organization. For instance, a second-hand furniture shop on your way to the train station actually relies on a certain amount of urban decay in order to attract business to their shop. They need that foot traffic to come past. They exchange cash for furniture that they deliver or for furniture that they buy. There's very little that a chamber could do if that business does not subscribe to membership. So there's limits to what business can do in order to address that problem. As far as the structural problems in the labour market is concerned, this is a huge issue. It's got a very long history. There's an number of things that used to institutionalize structural problems in our labor market that brought it about, a political problem. And later on, we still find ourselves with issues that institutionalize it. And I think we try to address it, as my colleague mentioned, in terms of asking for striving towards greater efficiency and how we spend our time. If you take an index like the World Bank Competitiveness Index, for instance, it's got a number of criteria that it judges economies against. And some of it relates to spending on social issues like housing, health, those types of things. The best way that an educator, the best way for a worker or a prospective employee of any sort to guarantee him or herself employment is obviously having skills that they can sell and offering the employment on the most flexible basis. And I think what we are asking for is just to make sure that we do what we can in order to get that balance right in terms of the economy. I'll end there.
We need to move. We need to give the other presenters an opportunity to respond. I see Philip with an appetite to say something. Very sure.
There was one question on the retention strategy by the private sector. I think in the private sector we're proud that people do move around because that's a clear function of a flexible and a working labor market. You cannot force people to stay in a residential climate here, and the fact that there's mobility of labor for us is a really useful indicator that we are doing well. So secondly, we see ourselves as really a conduit for labor mobility, and we are not ashamed to support that. Thank you. We do invest in people, which is why they become highly mobile. Maybe government should actually review why people don't move around within government.
If they are good, they must stay. Over to you.
Thank you. I'll just take the first bite of the questions and I'll comment to add if there are more. And I'll also try and answer the questions in combination with, I think a lot of questions also tackled different aspects of the same issue. So I'm hoping that I should cover everything. On the question of inflation targeting and the question of what would be an appropriate inflation target, and also as to whether or not inflation, a high inflation is a good thing. These are all related, I think, to our general, to the general concerns related. But firstly, I think we're clear as the PBC that inflation is not a good thing. I mean, it impacts directly on our constituencies. But we are concerned about having a narrow, one-sided policy that still undermines the very constituencies that we're representing. So we would have to find other ways of addressing that, but not necessarily through the exchange rate policy. And that's it. At some times, we may have to actually deal with high inflation as a short-term measure in order, of course, to, for example, promote a high industrialization in terms of job creation. I'll get into that later. In respect of putting ourselves down to an inflation target that we would find acceptable or fair, we don't believe that is a question that we should answer. I think that's the wrong way about going about it, because then it means then that we are agreeing that inflation targeting is a great model. And we think that rather you need to review monetary policy as a whole and broaden, as we argued for, broaden the mandate rather than have what looks like a more flexible mandate. And you'd include other variables where employment is the first factor that we'd address or we should focus on. And obviously, looking at all those other variables, then you'd obviously have to do the number crunching and work out from there what mechanisms. Inflation would be one of the factors, but it would not be the main factor. So we wouldn't want to put ourselves down and take ourselves to no pun intended, to a specific race at this stage. On the question of how do we fund the deficit, Now, I think this goes back to our overall argument that the episode is only your one indicator, not the final indicator of your orientation in terms of your spending in the budget. But it does not necessarily mean that you're spending more. So we obviously want to, as you said, in looking at fiscal policy and monetary policy overall aspects, there's certain aspects of the factors that actually influence the deficit without necessarily translating into more expansionary and broader social spending. So we want to address those factors first and foremost before we start looking at the funding of the deficit. And then more generally, we agree with the principles that Treasury and SARS and the moves that we're talking about in terms of one, broadening the tax base, and two, addressing inefficiencies in the tax base. Also, we've made proposals in relation to specific taxes that we want to see imposed, as I mentioned in my presentation. So that would obviously, to some extent, fund the deficit. On the question of what are the structural problems of unemployment in the labour market, I think the first thing we'd want to raise, which we'd emphasise in the presentation, is that the structural problems of the labour market affect people differently depending on which section of the labour market or your socioeconomic background. You know, and even if they're really looking at stats, specifically looking at even at the budget, where if you're a black person, if you've been denied opportunities in terms of access to education and training opportunities, that affects your, one, your entry into the labor market, and two, the level at which you enter the market, and three, your overall quality of employment, not just for your first job, your entry job, but for the rest of your employment life. And when we are talking about addressing employment, we've got to be really careful about just talking about job creation without looking at the quality of employment. It's not just a question of principle. If we look at what happened in terms of the quality of employment, even those informed employment, we've seen not just a decline in terms of worker share, in terms of the GDP, we've seen a decline in terms of benefits. And the question then is, what happens to those people, for example, who are not receiving retirement benefits or are not being funded in terms of social security? They've got, essentially, you'd be putting people in employment, but you're still enforcing a dependent cycle. Those people would technically be in employment. The idea is that we've addressed poverty, which is actually just notional in the sense that we haven't. In terms of their long-term sustainability and the household and family support, ultimately, they start depending on government and assistance. So we've got to look at a long-term view in terms of, one, job creation, and two, the type of employment, and the purpose of the quality of employment. We also, when we said that the problems are structural, the structural problems affect people differently, to note that we've got different problems in the labor market. There's some cases where we do not have enough jobs, obviously, in terms of the labor-intensive section, and that's obviously to meet the gap where people do not have adequate skills. But on the other hand, you have a situation where there's certain vacancies that just cannot get filled enough because you don't have skilled people. So the mismatch between not being able to fill vacancies on the one hand versus an oversupply of labor is really about, I think, basically a whole legacy of a disproportion in terms of access to opportunities and the broad range of socioeconomic opportunities. And you can't expect, for example, a child who comes from a home from a poor socioeconomic background to be the same as an older child. And it's not about capacity, it's about opportunity. On the question of the opposition to PPPs, we would have, I think first we should answer that generally in terms of the project service reliance on PPP. First and foremost, you know, the third concern is happening in terms of tendering and problems in terms of corruption. And if you look at this year's budget, the Treasury has put a lot of emphasis on trying to centralize more control on tendering at that level, which is an indication of problems in the tendering process and the needs and the shifts and which we support in terms of government trying to actually address that. But part of that, we think, is related to the fact that you've got a mechanism that involves what's called agencies, structures, institutions that have a very different objective in mind that's driven by profit measures versus the issue of service delivery. So we are concerned about that. Also, the question of accountability beyond corruption, in terms of making your overall objective, you lose control of the new PPPs. You are involving institutions that are not necessarily have the same objective in mind, and you can eventually compromise government priorities. And if you look at how PPPs are used across the board, in terms of different provinces and local bases, you can actually start to dilute priorities because you're obviously engaged with different agencies in different provinces, and there you'll find that the implementation becomes irregular. We're also concerned about the issue of security of supply, because if you use a different institution which changes from time to time, questions of capacity to deliver, questions in terms of input costs, and all of that stuff pertains to whether or not you've got security of supply for a particular service. And that ranges across the board, whether or not it's in public health or in terms of supply of nutritional schemes and so forth. On the question of dealing with those people in the labour market who are under 21 years old and currently who the argument was that the people cannot go back to school, we obviously have to implement, and I'm just speaking of the country, we obviously have to implement mechanisms that have a long-term view as well as more immediate-term responses. And the first thing we obviously need to look at is alternative mechanisms for training. And obviously, this is where you find that there will be a lot of criticism leveled at the implementation of skills development because that hasn't been adequately rolled out and implemented for the benefit of youth entering the market. The one thing we probably need to look at is how, for example, learnership rolled out, and how, for example, how we identify particular sectors in vocational training. But the question is that, okay, first and foremost, our view is so under 21, 15 to 18 should not be in the labour market, and I think that's a firm and hard position that we have. We feel that that age group needs to be diverted through some form of if not formal schooling through the high school system, through alternatives, through, like, for example, ACT colleges. And ACT colleges are also quite useful if rolled out adequately in terms of providing parallel educational mechanisms, but not just in terms of schooling at the high school, but also ensuring that people have certain vocational training. So we would, in that case, look at how ACT colleges can be used and improved to drive that mandate. On the concern that our criticism of informal jobs that are created and that most of those jobs are created by government, we just want to raise a point here. The issue of informal jobs in creative isn't just labeled as government. It's labeled across the board as also the private sector, it's not just in relation to, for example, the EPWPs. There's a move globally to move towards what we call atypical employment. And as we've pointed out, this actually compromises the quality of employment. And essentially, it defers, not just defers, actually removes any kind of obligation for employers to take responsibility and contribute to our differences overall, to some extent, overall well being employee lifetime. Because obviously, when they get the benefit of personal employment, it is the result of the person who's got to go through an entire life cycle. So we're not actually criticizing only government's emphasis on informal jobs. We're also criticizing the private sector, and we think that there has to be a shift towards ensuring that people are put into permanent, more regular forms of typical jobs that ensures an overall more sustainable emphasis on what access to employment does for someone quality of life, essentially, in the long term. And then also there was, I think, a concern specifically, it was said that what do our children do who are not employed? Just to note, the constituencies, and I think this argument also comes at the times where I'm speaking to this case, without having labeled as the labor bureaucracy, which we believe is not correct. If you look at where our constituencies come from in our household, essentially the unemployed are located in our household. It's our membership who have children who have difficulties entering the employment. If you look at the incomes and the levels of incomes that they earn, it's the children of our membership who have difficulties accessing the very opportunities that we want them to be denied from. And we are concerned that there are perceptions that there is some division between what we represent and the broader working class, and also the creation of artificial barriers between those who are employment and employment, and those who are unemployed. Because you find that there isn't this division in communities, there isn't this division in households. People are drawn from the same household. You find that there's an additional tax on someone who's employed because they're normally supporting a household. Often it's an extended family of unemployed people. So we would caution against allowing artificial factors to creep in that seek to undermine any kind of understanding or undermine a way of us arriving at a common understanding how to deal with this structural problems of unemployment. On the question of the...
Can I just indicate that you could look at other members of the team coming to make a presentation and be on the floor for almost 12 minutes. And by half past we should be within the chamber.
Okay, there's one more thing
I want
to
ask
you. On the question of Gini coefficient, currently, we rely primarily on the studies that have been the Gini coefficient having worsened. We've actually relied on the current studies and stats that have been circulated as we said. But we find that those statistics actually confirm and reinforce each other. Even if you look at statistics in terms of earnings and employment earnings in terms of released by StatsSA. So the question of inequalities has actually worsened. And if you look at, for example, things like the director survey in terms of what executives pay how it has escalated also in terms of additional fringe benefits, then we feel that if you look for confirmatory signals, you'd get them there. So we haven't done our own research, but if the committee feels that it's necessary, we could look at that. On the question of the concern that what obviously we've raised is that some of these inequalities may be worse now than during apartheid. With this, obviously, there's some sensitivity, and it's not necessarily, it's not saying at all that the situation is better now, better under apartheid than versus under the current democratic government. In fact, we previously raised concerns that essentially, at the end of the apartheid regime, what was the foundation for the economy that we have now was set up as a result and by the Union Party regime, and we obviously have not reversed all of that. So this shouldn't be seen as some sort of endorsement of the mechanisms under the Party regime at all, but just it's more an indicator that we need to be taking up comments of. Thank you.
I just want to make one or two comments about the training layoff scheme. It wasn't asked for the other day in the paper, and it's true that people who work haven't really, and employers haven't really responded to this in the numbers that we thought they would. The thing is this, is that when the scheme was put into place, and we all agreed that the intention of the scheme was to actually minimize the effects of retrenchment. And we thought, well, look, it's a good thing. I mean, you've got to have something there in response to the crisis, and the retrenchments and the layoffs were really, really beginning to soar. But the one thing, something, this happens, and sometimes what we overlook is that we overlook the kind of human emotions that normally come when with the prospect of a person being unemployed. And we don't have empirical evidence yet. We haven't done detailed research on this. Some of the discussions that we've had with workers on the shop floor, and these are the kind of things that come about, is that we ask them, well, look, the day of training layoff scheme, and have you talked to your employees, and we don't take advantage of it. And this is the kind of answer we get, is that there's an enormous amount of anxiety and fear that comes with the prospect of retrenchment. And to try to convince them otherwise sometimes is really difficult. Sometimes the employer himself is reluctant to do that. He just wants to say, well, look, I want to get, this is what I can do now. There's a lot of paperwork. You have to get to the CCMA, you have to get the parties together, you have to get agreements together. And the employer sometimes says, look, he doesn't have the resources or capacity to do that. So he's in a hurry now just to get rid of workers. Workers on the other hand, faced with anxiety, I say, okay, look, I'd rather take my package and gamble with the prospect of maybe I find a job somewhere else in the economy. So these are the kinds of things sometimes that we tend to overlook. We tend to take it for granted that, oh, there's a training layoff scheme and it's going to work. But like I say, human factors must be taken into account. And we need in some ways to quantify it. And we need to say, well, look, how can we make the training scheme then? Can we make it a bit more lucrative? Can we make it a bit better? And maybe this is something that we need to talk about a bit more. There are going to be implications for this, certainly with the budget, but I think we need to look into this a bit more carefully. And not just take things for granted. On the issue of decent work now, you know, there's a lot being said about decent work. And a question arose the other day, and I think it was a portfolio committee on labor. There was a briefing by the Department of Labor on their program. And this question of decent work came up quite a few times. And the thing about it is that government, business, labor, all agree on the principle. But sometimes we don't look at, well, what's really in this whole, what's in this concept of decent work? And the thing is, when we look at, and my colleague has referred to this, about that we want to create a work that is more stable, more sustainable. And this is the thing about decent work, is that there are four underlying elements here. One is that there's security of employment. And this is something that we have to work about, so security of employment for sustainable livelihood. The other one is about labor rights, and then about having at least be able to work in a safe, healthy environment. And the fourth one, which is a more tricky one, is how do you extend these rights to those workers who are on the periphery of the labour market? That means on the fringes of the labour market, and that would be the casual and informal workers who are informally employed, casual workers, temporary workers, and so on. And this is going to be a very tricky one, because you can't speak of these rights as a preserve of just those in the formal labour market. You'd have to look at this informal labour market. It's expanding. It is. There's more workers actually being put on the fringes of the labour market. And say, well, look, how do you extend these rights to workers who are put on these fringes? So the debate, and I think there has to be much more debate around this. We've got to take it across to some of the departments. We can't just locate it in a budgetary portfolio committee. I think that the portfolio committee on labour must look into this very seriously as well. So the thing about decent work, layoff schemes, we feel is, I think there needs to be a lot more discussion on this. But for us, it's important that it's going to have implications for the budget, and maybe we need to take this up a bit more, in a more concrete way. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any other questions? I
I see Honorable Tefa and the Honorable Saints your concentration span is deteriorated. And I guess you are on a 2-hour flight to Devon from here, so you catch up in the plane. For now, be with us. I think before I wrap up, if there's any other point that the presenter would want to say. Musa, any other last point?
No, thank you, Chair. I think we appreciate very much the engagement. I think it's always been challenging. And I think the idea of having started an hour presentation together has also worked quite well, because you're reading some of the things with the main factors. So I think it's been quite a constructive discussion, and as far as we're concerned, all the points that we would want to cover have been raised, and we hope we've responded to all the points that we've been raised. So thank you very much.
Thank you. Likewise, we just want to say we're grateful for the opportunity to engage with this, and we also want to commend this committee for actually ensuring a more participatory process through the Money Amendment Bill. For us, obviously, that has faced increased challenges, because this is the first time we're engaging in the budgetary process in more than 10 years. So the technical challenges have basically increased upon us because of the time constraints. So we will be looking at further opportunities to engage in the process going forward. And we don't think this is the final engagement, but we are very, very grateful for the inclusive manifesto.